You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Alexandra Lang is my guest. She's an historian and architecture critic and the author of several books, including The Design of Childhood, How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids. Her new book is an incredibly interesting and wide-ranging history of the mall, and it is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexandra Lang, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess I have a different relationship with the mall than you, because when I was a kid, I loved this little amusement park. It was in West Hollywood. It was called Beverly Park, and it had these dinky little rides, and there was a little pony ride, and everybody had their birthday parties there. And now there's this gigantic behemoth called the Beverly Center, right where Beverly Park used to be. And when I first moved up here to Santa Cruz, there was a cool little brown bulb cattle ranch, it was called. And they had all these longhorn steer there. And now there's the Capitola Mall there, which is, you know, a blight, in my opinion. So I guess I didn't particularly love the mall or relate to the mall in the way that I guess future generations did.
Yeah, I think people's reactions to the mall are very generational. Like I'm 49, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s. So the mall was already an established thing that you kind of grew into and then had really important teen experiences at. But I can imagine if I were slightly older and I had seen malls, you know, kind of take away green space, take away, you know, fun old things like that amusement park, I might have a different relationship to it. Like I didn't see it when it was being born. I saw it as kind of a fact on the ground.
The Beverly Center is one in particular that I find to be, it's so, well, you talked a little bit in your book about how the outside of the mall is completely unimportant to people who design malls.
Yes. There are a number of early malls, like 1950s, early 1960s, that had rather elegant exteriors. I sometimes compare them to the architecture of Lincoln Center, kind of that stripped down modernism, very simple columns and overhangs. But mall owners soon found that it really didn't pay to dress up the outside of your mall. Like you were fine with these big boxes with like a giant department store logo on it. So they put much more money into the inside of the mall.
Yeah, you were talking about one of the malls that had this kind of cool, circular outside things, which turned out to be dressing rooms when you got inside.
Yeah, that's North Park in Dallas. And the Neiman Marcus at North Park in Dallas was designed by the partners of Eero Saarinen, who's, you know, famous for the TWA terminal and other rather swoopy buildings.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting department store design because it's largely a very elegant blank white box. And then it has these half cylinders popping out and it takes you, you know, you have to go inside and pick out your clothes and make it all the way to the dressing rooms before you find out that in fact, those half cylinders are the dressing rooms. And there's a skylight on top. So you have natural light so you can see the real color of the clothes.
You know, today we're deluged with politics. You know, politics is everywhere and it's very divisive and everybody knows this. And I thought, oh, good. Well, I can read a book about the mall and I'll be free from reading about it. So issues of race have always been an issue in mall. And I was just like shocked. I mean, in the original design of malls, race was an issue.
Yeah. And that was something I kind of knew about peripherally and mostly anecdotally. But as I started to trace the history of malls, especially honestly writing this book mostly in 2020 after George Floyd was killed, I was just like, no, like we really have to talk about this because otherwise I'm obscuring the origins of the mall. And really the first place that race intersects with the mall is just that the suburbs that were built during the post-war era were either by law or in effect white suburbs, like Black people, people of color weren't allowed to buy houses there. And the malls were built for the people living in those suburbs. So the target audience for the mall and all of the people living within easy driving distance of the mall would all have been white.
And driving has a lot to do with it too, right? Because there was, the malls were set up for people to drive there and have big parking lots.
Yeah. I mean, the way I describe it is the federal government in the post-war era gave all this money to states to build new highways and gave all this money to homeowners to buy new houses, single family houses through low cost mortgages, which would have had a carport or a garage. But they didn't think about what was going to go between those two things. Like the people needed a third place that wasn't their office or their home or their interior of their car. And so the design of the mall reflects that culture because you had to drive from your house to the mall and there had to be enough parking. But I also think, you know, part of the point of the mall was to give people a place to get out of their car and see each other like beyond their own driveway.
But so in terms of race, apparently, I guess that if you were someone who lived farther away or were taking a bus, then it wasn't as easy to access the mall.
Yeah. Early mall developers really were only interested in kind of middle and upper class shoppers. And they thought that people taking the bus were more likely to be lower income. And so a lot of times they would ask for, if there were a bus stop near the mall, for it to be put way out at the edge of the parking lot or even across on the other side of the highway, which made it really difficult for bus riders to access the mall.
And race continues to be an issue in your story of malls as time goes by, in terms of, well, you mentioned an episode of Everybody Hates Chris, in which they go to the mall and they're being pursued. I mean, I guess what it is, it's about the difference between having a police force and having a private police force. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a sort of ongoing debate in many spheres about the mall. Like, is it a public space or is it a private space? A lot of people treat it as a public space and think about it as an extension of their town and as a ersatz town square. But in fact, malls are built on private property and they have their own police force in the form of mall cops. And they often have pretty strict codes of conduct that are more likely to be enforced on Black and brown teenagers than they are on white teenagers. So I have a chapter where I talk a lot about how these kind of real life policing incidents that have happened at malls are reflected in the different ways that malls are seen in teen, sort of Black teen media versus white teen media. So like white teen media is things like Clueless that show the white teenagers going on a fun shopping trip at the mall. Black teen media is something like Everybody Hates Chris, in which he has this really funny sequence in which the mall cops are pursuing first like a tiny Black child and then a Black grandmother through the store, just kind of automatically assuming that they are not shoppers and might be shoplifting. And there are a bunch of other Black teen TV shows that have incidents where kids, like kind of the stars of the show, are picked up by the mall cops and falsely accused of shoplifting. So like what can seem to be this freeing, wonderful space for one demographic can be really highly policed for another demographic. Children behave. That's what they say.
That was Tiffany with, I think We're Alone Now. Tiffany famously toured malls when she had her moment of stardom. And Alexandra Lang, your book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall, references lots of wonderful popular culture events that intersect with the mall, like television shows and movies and music. And I haven't read a lot of architecture criticism, but is that something unique to your style of writing, that you discuss the intersection of popular culture and architecture?
I don't think it's unique, but I do think that over the past few years, architecture criticism has really broadened in scope. Like, fewer and fewer architecture critics are really writing about buildings. More and more of us are writing about cities in general. And then I personally like love pop culture, and I'm, you know, like that's what I'm looking at in my free time. And I realized that one way to help more people connect with architecture criticism was to talk about how, you know, TV and movies use architecture. Like, I wrote a whole piece for Curbed about the kitchen designs in the show Big Little Lies and how they reflect the different personalities of the different women on the show. And I've written about Black Mirror and other TV shows where the design of the environments really interacts with the plot. So to me, then, writing about malls and talking about the way malls are perceived and shown in these different teen TV shows felt really natural. I mean, I mean, one of the things that's fun about being a critic is it's really personal. Everyone, you can have five critics look at the same thing and each of them will have their own take. So I'm not sure there's anyone else that would have put Everybody Hates Chris in their mall book, but I felt really compelled to do it. And I felt like that was a way to get more people kind of hooked into some of the larger points I wanted to make about how malls are designed and how they've evolved.
I've found some surprising people showing up in your book as I was hearing about the origins of the mall. And Ray Bradbury is one of those. What role did Ray Bradbury play in the creation of the mall?
Yeah, that was really one of my most fun discoveries. You know, Ray Bradbury is, you know, author of The Martian Chronicles, one of the major science fiction authors of the 20th century. And it turned out he loved malls. And in the early 1970s, he wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times magazine about how teenagers and other people in Los Angeles needed somewhere to go. And what he describes is kind of an open plaza with anchor stores that sounds a lot like an outdoor mall. And an architect named John Jurdy, who was then working for a major mall developer, read this piece and thought, oh, like, this guy really gets it. And then a few years later, Jurdy wrote to Ray Bradbury and said, I'm designing a new mall for downtown San Diego. Would you be willing to write something, kind of a mood setting piece, like about what a mall should be? And Bradbury wrote this great essay on lostness, where he talks about how the point of the mall should be to be able to get lost, to end up in some like dark attic at the top where there's like a magic store and an arcade and someone, you know, selling costumes. And Jurdy kind of incorporated this, I would say, conceptually into his design for Horton Plaza in San Diego.
That's amazing. And did Ray Bradbury acknowledge his contributions to the world of mall?
He did. Bradbury and Jurdy were friends and kind of, you know, had an ongoing conversation with each other. And there's an interview that Bradbury did late in life at the Paris Review where he talks about his interest in malls. Apparently he also at one point like talked to Disney about writing things for them. So he was very connected to different people that were trying to build and visualize the future.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Alexandra Lang. Her books include The Design of Childhood and her new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall.
Well, I was just going to ask you about Disney. So Disney also, I mean, I don't think Disney consciously thought of a mall, but I mean, his original design for Epcot that didn't actually occur was a kind of a revolutionary Community of Tomorrow mall, right?
Yeah. It was a revolutionary Community of Tomorrow It had great public transportation. It has had kind of smart land use. I actually wrote a little bit about Epcot in my previous book, The Design of Childhood, when I was looking at family-friendly city planning, because yeah. Disney, in a way, is a very family-friendly city. It's all about pedestrian life and moving from like a green space to a main street. And, you know, even at Epcot, there is, you know, the House of Tomorrow and that sort of thing. So Disney ends up popping up as kind of a referential figure for a lot of the people developing malls, Jurdy and Ray Bradbury, yes, but also James Rouse, who is a really important developer on the East Coast, met at different times with Disney, and they had a lot of discussions.
Disney died in 1966, and as a result, Epcot, as he designed it, was jettisoned, and instead they made basically a kind of a World's Fair restaurant out of it or whatever. I don't know what
yeah,
you call it.
Yeah.
But
a giant sculpture.
Yeah. Had the original Epcot been built, do you think that it would have had an effect on cities internationally?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, the U.S. hadn't really gotten into that kind of large-scale urban planning. You know, in the early 1960s, there was a lot of large-scale suburban planning. But what Disney planned at Epcot was really a kind of graduated series of, you know, tall buildings in the center of town, then housing outside, and then a really broad green belt. And it was all connected by trains, and all of the roads were buried underground. So, you know, you can see a lot of themes that people still want to bring into our urban planning in the, you know, kind of unbuilt plans for Epcot.
Kind of sad.
Yeah. I mean, that's what people always feel about utopias. You know, of course, an author like Bradbury probably would have uncovered the dark side of that vision. Like, if we built it, like, would we have loved it? That's always the question. But yeah, I mean, I often look at utopian ideas and you're just kind of dazzled by the ambition and you want to see what would happen. Like, there's a curiosity there.
Sure. Yeah. I was in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and I was standing in the Smithsonian at the information desk, and this group of teenagers came up and said, "Where's the mall?" And she said, "This is the mall. This is a mall? This is not a mall." You know, they were like appalled. But in your book, you talked about the origin of the word mall, that it has to do with a game that was played on the street in England.
In London, yes. Yes, the National Mall and the shopping mall, the origin of the word is the same. Basically, there was this Italian sort of bowling game that was played and became popular on a London street called Pall Mall, which was a long, narrow landscape strip surrounded by buildings. And so from the popularity of that game and its association with the specific architecture of Pall Mall, a mall in landscape terms came to be a long, narrow landscape strip between buildings. So if you think about the National Mall in Washington, that's what it is, you know, Smithsonian museums on either side, Capitol and the Washington Monument at either end. And it's the same for your basic shopping mall, shops on either side, fountains and benches in the middle, and then a department store at each end.
In Santa Cruz, there was an area that was called the Pacific Garden Mall. Now it's just called downtown because... because it's not a mall in the way that people now think of a mall, because it's a street with shops on it.
Right. But was it a pedestrian mall? Was it closed to cars?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. That's the other, yes. And it is, the nomenclature is quite confusing to a lot of people. And that's why you have to kind of use, you know, National Mall, shopping mall, pedestrian mall. But yeah, that pedestrian mall had the same shape, you know, landscaped or car-free strip in the middle, shops all around. So again, they were referring to the same street in London that, you know, never realized it was going to get this famous.
That's amazing. In Alexander Lang, in your book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall, you talk a lot about popular music and how popular music intersects with the mall, and that some pop music acts use the mall. Can you talk a little bit about that? I thought that was so great.
Sure. Yeah, this was one of the fun things that I kind of had on my master list when I was doing you know, doing my advanced planning, I, you know, scribbled down something like Tiffany at the mall, because I remembered from my own childhood that there were all these teen singers that had sung at the mall. So the idea was these singers were not popular enough yet to fill a stadium. And their audiences were expected to be fellow teenagers. So where do you find teenagers? At the mall. So Tiffany is probably the most famous. She sang, I Think We're Alone Now, which was huge, huge hit. So she had concerts at the mall. Then later Britney Spears went on a multi-mall tour. And there, Debbie Gibson, there are several others. Yeah. And there's even, and this was kind of a funny meta thing, in the TV show, How I Met Your Mother, there's a character that is revealed to have been a former Canadian teen pop star. And there's
Robin Sparkles or something.
Robin Sparkles. So there's a fake Robin Sparkles video that you can watch on YouTube in which she sings about the mall and dances in the atrium of a mall. So, I mean, like, my point with all of this was that the atrium is this really important space in teen life and teen culture. And you can see that reflected in the way that major corporations, you know, sold teenage stars to other teenagers through these mall concerts.
It's amazing.
But it's really fun to, like, go online and be like, how many dates at malls did Britney Spears play in? Now, I can't remember what the year was, but yeah. And you can find all that out. It's just people refer to it in
1992 or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, I sure thought she would be a passing, you know, I thought she would be about as popular as Tiffany, but she somehow has persisted.
Yeah. And honestly, people really care about Britney Spears.
Like, oh, they really do.
Everyone wants her to do well and be happy.
I guess I was turned off by the hit me one more time thing, because I thought, you know, that's not a good, I don't know if you ever listened to the lyrics of Hit Me One More Time.
Yeah. I actually read a whole book by John Seabrook about kind of the making of pop music during that era.
Yeah.
And according to him, I think this is what he says, it's kind of a mistranslation by the Swedish hit makers that were working with Britney at that time. So they didn't really mean it to be like a hit, but it's certainly easy to interpret the lyrics that way.
Especially since in the music video, she's every time the word hit me comes, she thrusts her fist forward.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are something like, you know, we were together and I didn't like the way you wanted it to be, but it's better than being alone. So hit me, baby, one more time.
Yeah.
Lovely. What a lovely.
But sentence. Yeah, he says that he meant like, hit me up, like call me.
Yeah. Baby, how was I supposed to know that something wasn't right? Well, that's what my students, I used to teach middle school, and my middle school students insisted that I was wrong in my interpretation.
Oh, okay.
I said, but that's what she's saying. All right. It's a 30-year-old argument. I don't need to have it again. And yet I'm doing it. And there's room in your book for zombies.
Yes. Many, many people, when I said I was writing about malls, said to me, oh, you're going to write about Dawn of the Dead. Like, I mean, it's a very popular movie. It's a cult classic, and it is largely set in a closed shopping mall that has been taken over by zombies. And I have to say, I do not like horror movies. And that is a particularly gross horror movie. When I went back and read some of the contemporary reviews of it, I found out that Janet Maslin, who was the New York Times film critic, had left after 15 minutes. And she said that in the paper. And I was like, oh, you know, if I'd had a choice, I might have left after 15 minutes too. So I just sort of watched it through my fingers. But the interesting thing about Dawn of the Dead is that it's quite a good movie as commentary, basically, on who are the zombies, because you're seeing these zombies move around this shopping mall, which was a real mall, the Monroeville Mall, which is outside Pittsburgh and is kind of like a legend in Pittsburgh. But you're also seeing the unzombified humans behave in some very consumerist ways, even though they're, you know, fighting for their lives and it might be the end of the world, they're still manipulated by the mall. So there's this question, I think, in Romero's, that Romero, the director, is trying to plant in your mind, like, who are the zombies? What are we really doing at the mall? And if you see it like that, it's actually like quite, you know, cutting cultural commentary. And it's part of a whole wave of critique of the mall that starts to build in the late 1970s.
The thing about the mall, you know, as you were saying, you know, everybody has a different relationship with it. But, and your book is very up to date, because you talk quite a bit about COVID-19 and the pandemic. And even before the pandemic, malls were struggling. Our mall, the Capitola Mall here in Santa Cruz, the Sears closed, and that was one of the big anchor stores. And the other end has gone through a couple of different major stores. There was Mervyn's, and they went away. The mall was struggling even before. Do you think that that your history of the mall has come at a time when it might be the end of the mall?
Well, all of the mall experts that I talked to, like on the business side, said that they felt that COVID-19 had maybe exacerbated some of the existing problems with malls, but hadn't created new ones. So they might have sped up the timeline a bit, but it didn't really change the narrative that was already happening. And the problematic part of the narrative, in business terms, is really what you just said, the death of the anchor stores and the death of department stores. Sears, you know, went out of business. Macy's has closed a lot of stores, or, you know, JCPenney is gone. All of these stores that, at least for me, like, were just around in my youth, were very useful to go to when you needed like underwear, camping gear, whatever, are gone. And I read a great article in Vox that said that, yeah, department stores are the big weakness of the mall, not necessarily the boutiques that make up the other parts of the mall. So if you own a mall and you want to, you know, keep it going, you really need to start thinking creatively about what other anchors can be. Because the department store is probably not coming back. Like, they believe, and I believe, that people still want to shop and walk around and get lunch, and the kind of social and community functions of the mall are still with us because they're very, you know, basic human desires. But to keep a mall healthy, you have to figure out things that you can put in those big anchor stores at the end that people still want to come out for. And a major one of those is actually food. There are a lot of malls that are basically turning what had been a solo department store into kind of a marketplace food hall, like an expanded version of the old food courts in malls, because food is a big driver of commerce these days. People are really interested in it.
When I was a kid, another place that I went, and I guess it was a mall, and I didn't realize it, was the Farmers Market, which is on Fairfax. Now there's a big mall there as well.
But I think now they've moved the Farmers Market inside the former department store and, you know, kind of arrange it around the middle and have an atrium. You can kind of visualize this, I think.
Yeah. There was a Saturday Night Live routine back in the 70s where there was this mall that everything was dying and all the stores were closed except the Scotch Tape Boutique. The Scotch Tape Boutique. The Scotch Tape Boutique was doing bang up business, and everybody went to the Scotch Tape Boutique.
People love stationery stores, actually. Like, they do. I would bet on that one.
I understand the convenience of computer generated shopping, but and you can get it now. You can order something, you know, 5 seconds later it comes to your door. But going into a bookstore or a record store used to be a thing where you would talk to the people that worked there, and they were knowledgeable about music and books, and that's how you learned. And it was different than Amazon saying, "Oh, you bought this, you might also want to buy this." It was people's opinions rather than an algorithm, and that's something I really miss.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of experience that retail in general needs to build on, and that then will help malls survive. I think that internet shopping isn't going away, and it did increase during the pandemic for obvious reasons. But I think internet shopping is really best for very utilitarian things that aren't fun to shop for anyway, like whatever you buy at the drugstore, or, you know, underwear, or, you know, in my case, like the 10 pairs of gray shorts I need for my son at camp. Like, I don't need to touch those. Like, that's not a fun shopping trip. But on the other hand, you know, a bookstore or a record store or a jewelry store, or even just, you know, nicer clothing, special occasion clothing store, you do want to touch everything, see what the fabric is, you know, talk to a sales associate that actually has an opinion and, you know, can help you put things together. And I think people are missing that, and they don't get the same pleasure out of shopping online. Plus, that other kind of shopping, you know, offline shopping, can also be social. You do it with your friends.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're getting back now to more of my conversation with architecture critic Alexandra Lang. She's the author of The Design of Childhood and her new book, A Fascinating History of Malls, called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall.
Yeah, no, to me, when I went to the mall occasionally, you know, I would steer clear of Hot Topic, because to me that was like the Scotch that was like the Scotch tape boutique. But in fact, you talk a lot about Hot Topic and what a phenomenon it was.
Yeah, I had sort of there are a lot of brands, especially in the 80s and 90s, that are really meaningful to people, that, you know, people who were kids in that era really identified with, like, they were a Hot Topic person, or they were, in my case, I was a Gap person, or, you know, other stores. And I had a lot of debate about how far down the rabbit hole of individual brands to go. I said this at an event last night, and someone was like, I would read a whole, if you want to write a book about like the 9 brands of the 90s, I would totally read that book. And I was like, okay, I'll think about that. That's another book though. But yeah. Hot Topic was interesting because it intersects with a lot of the other topics that I was already writing about. For example, the teen stars of the Twilight movies went on a mall tour, and that was sponsored by Hot Topic. So Robert Pattinson would sit outside the Hot Topic in some, you know, mall somewhere in California, signing t-shirts while 1,000 girls screamed. So, I mean, Hot Topic really knew what was up in terms of teen culture. And then it brought that to some really, you know, far-flung places. So I have just an anecdote from the advice columnist J.P. Brammer, saying that he lived in like a rural part of the West, and Hot Topic was the only place where he felt like he could see a little bit of alternative culture. And so, like, of course it was a corporate entity, of course it was a chain store, but if you're living in a pretty conformist environment, just being able to buy the Doc Martens, or being able to buy a Metallica t-shirt or eyeliner or whatever it is, just makes you feel a little more seen and helps you express yourself in a way that you might not otherwise be able to.
And I guess the idea that, I mean, when we think about JCPenney's or Woolworth's or Macy's, the things that they have at Macy's are always the things that they have at Macy's, and they have them in the same spot and in the same place, and it's the same thing. And if you got it there 5 years ago, it's still going to be there. But with Hot Topic, if you got it there last week, it may not be there this week, because they're always changing their merchandise and their focus.
Yeah. I mean, we're much more used to that now, because there are many more stores doing fast fashion, which is an environmental problem, and I do not really advocate for it. But there was a newsiness to what you could buy at Hot Topic, which is the same thing that you can find at bookstores. I mean, that's why they put the racks of bestsellers right up front, because those generally turn over and it makes people say, oh, like, I haven't seen that yet.
But a bookstore can exist anywhere. I mean, you'd be driving down the street and go, oh, a bookstore, pull over. But Hot Topic was only in a mall. You couldn't find a Hot Topic on the street.
Yeah, Hot Topic was only in a mall. It's interesting, though. Earlier this spring, I wrote a story for City Lab about nostalgia for mall bookstores, because I do think those chain bookstores, especially the small ones like Walden Books and V. Dalton, that just, you know, fit into one of those boutique size spaces, served an important role that independent bookstores that you have to seek out and drive to separately don't necessarily serve. Like, they sold a lot of books, especially in genre categories, you know, like mysteries, thrillers, romance, and were very non-judgmental about it, and just, you know, had the new books super easy to pick up on the way to your other errands.
Well, you know, part of that was the people that worked there were kids, you know, as in most malls, who had never read any books and didn't have any judgments to make about what book you bought.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. It's like, yes, we want a curated experience, but we also don't want to be judged for what we like. So, you know, it's like, some bookstores are better for some things and some are better for others. And I just thought it was interesting to hear people talk about, you know, how they felt about Walden Books, which I think when it, you know, met its end, people didn't mourn it in particular. But now that we don't have something like that around, you're like, oh, that would have been really convenient.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about video arcades and the, and the controversy that they generated.
Yeah. I mean, I spent some time in video arcades in my youth. And if you think about where arcades are located in malls, they usually weren't right off the main concourse. They were down a hallway, either on the first floor or on the second floor, sort of tucked away. And initially, mall owners liked arcades because they saw them as kind of a containment zone for teenagers, right? Like, if you're trying to attract mostly, you know, middle-aged, middle-class shoppers, like, they don't necessarily want to see too many teenagers, or teenagers can get rowdy. So it's like, okay, we have the arcade, the teenagers will stay in their place in the arcade and the food court, basically.
Yeah.
But over the years, parents started getting really worried about kind of what was happening to the teens in the arcade. Like, were the arcade games rotting their minds? Were they making them violent? Were they causing them to have like a Nintendo arm injury? So there's a lot of kind of
what did
panic.
You say? Pac-Man wrist or something?
Pac-Man like that. Wrist. Yes. Like, what initially seemed like a benign place for teens to be with other teens, you know, like to have friendly competition, to hang out, started to seem to parents like this dangerous space where they didn't understand what was happening. And then compounding that was the rise of home computer game systems, starting with Atari, so that kids didn't have to go to the mall to play games. And then parents felt like, okay, if they're playing games at home, they're under, you know, more supervision. But again, I think that takes away some of the fun, because it's important for teenagers to establish, you know, their own friendships and have a sense of independence. And that was a really important thing that the mall did.
Anything kids enjoy, parents are worried about.
Yeah. Anything they enjoy, like, somebody will create a problem around it.
There was a whole comic book scandal in the 50s about how comic books were rotting our minds.
Yeah. And yeah.
I remember when television... you know, I mean, there was already TV when I was born, but my parents were like, you missed radio. Radio was a time when you had to use your imagination. You sit in front of that idiot box or the boob tube or whatever they called it. You know, they thought television was going to be the worst thing for us.
Right. Now kids, I mean, my own kids are listening to podcasts all the time. And I feel like somebody's going to swoop in and say, oh, they're spending too much time on their phone, you know? But actually, I mean, they're amazing podcasts. My older son loves it. There's a D&D podcast that he listens to, and it sounds really interesting.
Maybe he'd like From the Bookshelf. That's this one that we're on right now.
I know, I know. My younger son is more of a reader, and I do think there are probably some like middle grade and YA podcasts about books out there that he'd really enjoy.
Well, Alexandra Lang, how did you come to write Meet Me by the Fountain?
Well, I've been working for many years as the architecture critic for the website Curbed. And during that time, I, you know, wrote, you know, many columns per year. And one of the ones that interested me the most was when I found out that Renzo Piano, who's a Pritzker Prize winning architect, when I found out that he was designing something that sounded like a mall in outside in the Bay Area. It's called City Center Bishop Ranch. And everyone was kind of marveling at the idea that like such a famous architect would design a mall. And I was like, well, actually, you know, if I recall correctly, many famous architects designed malls, just, you know, kind of not in our recent memory. So I wrote a column where I talked about the design of City Center Bishop Ranch. And then I talked about the origin of malls and said, basically, like, what he's doing is what malls were originally intended to do, to create a community space in the suburbs where there were none, to create this kind of European style piazza, as Piano put it. And harking back to the days of Victor Gruen, who was sort of the father of malls and really modeled them on his own childhood and youth in Vienna, Austria. So that I wrote that story. And then I just kind of kept following mall discourse. I wrote a story about Hudson Yards when it opened in Manhattan, which was a huge deal. And I wrote a story about pedestrian malls, which were super popular in the 1970s and then went out of style. But I see them coming back in all of the interest in open streets that we have now. So I really, I wrote this series of articles, and then I thought, well, wait, if I'm writing these articles and I keep having new ideas relating to malls, maybe this could be a book.
And it's a really great book, I have to say. My wife wanted to take my mother-in-law on a trip. I think it was for her 75th or birthday or something. And she said, Mom, I want to take you to Paris. I love Paris, and you haven't been, and let's go to Paris. And she said, oh, honey, what a wonderful thing. I don't really want to go to Paris. I'd like to go to the Mall of America. And Robin was like, no, I don't want to go.
Oh, I was about to say, did she do it?
No, they didn't do it. But I have visited the Mall of America. The Mall of America is in Minnesota. It's crazy. There's it's like an amusement park, and there's an aquarium, and there's all these rides.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Actually, sorry, I'm getting a low. Do you mind if I just like pick up my computer and walk around? I'm getting a low battery signal, so I have to go plug it in, but hopefully it will be fine. The Mall of America is really interesting because it was actually designed to basically do just that, to let Americans have an international experience, like in the privacy of their own country. Because when it was originally designed, each wing leading off from the central amusement park was basically designed to invoke a different other tourist area. Like there's one wing that's supposed to look like New Orleans, and there's one wing that's supposed to look like a European Market Street. And I can't remember the other two right now, actually. But yes, I mean, your mother-in-law is kind of correct that she could see Paris without leaving the US if she went to the Mall of America. And that was part of what they were selling when it was initially built.
My wife had a prejudice against the whole idea of the mall. Yeah.
You know, actually, one of the sad things in my research that I didn't get to do was I had a family trip scheduled to the Mall of America for April 2020. We were planning to go to the Mall of America for spring break. Like I was going to stay in the hotel that was attached to the Mall of America. We were going to go on all the amusement park rides. Blacklight mini golf, I thought sounded really cool. Go to the aquarium. And then unfortunately that got canceled because of the pandemic.
It's not too late.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll happen next year.
Yeah.
Well, the book is just endlessly fascinating. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall, and the author, the brilliant Alexandra Lang, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.